started Wednesday's lesson last week with the purpose statement in John's Gospel, and that's in John 20, verses 30 and 31. And that's where John wrote, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." So depending on how you group the signs, there are seven or eight signs in John, and the main seven come from chapter 2 through chapter 12, but then we'll look at the last major sign at the end of the gospel this week. Let's do a little bit of review first, because like I said, seven of the eight major signs that John recorded are in 2:1 to 12:50. So we'll do a little bit of review of what we covered last week and then get into new material. The first sign we looked at was Jesus turning water into wine, and that's documented in John 2:1 through 11. And his first sign at the wedding revealed his power over time, because the Father is always making water into wine, but he takes a season or two to finish that work. The first sign, though, pointed to the kind of transforming ministry that Jesus would have. And today, remember, he shows his transforming power by changing sinners into children of God. Then John 4:46 through 54 told us about the second sign. And these verses describe how Jesus healed the royal official's son. The key to understanding the significance of the second sign is geography. Because remember, the nobleman and his dying son lived in Capernaum, which was the main city of the Galilee region, but Jesus was 20 miles away in Cana whenever he healed the royal official's son. So the second recorded sign then showed Jesus' power over space. And the lesson of the second sign is that Jesus is able to save from death even at a great distance. His word has the power to work, and people are simply to believe his word. Then the third sign is the healing of the paralytic, and that sign comes in chapter 5, verses 1 through 17. And verses 5, 8, and 9 give us Jesus' words to the paralytic. He said, "Jesus said to him, 'Rise up, take up your bed, and walk.' And immediately the man was made well, took up his bed, and walked. And that day was the Sabbath." Once again, we see Jesus' word accomplish his will, and of course this illustrates the conversion process. When people obey the command to believe, God works in and through his word to save them. The story of the healing at the Pool of Bethesda actually highlighted the beginning of the open hostility toward Jesus in the Jerusalem and the southern parts of Palestine. So rather than being happy for the man, remember how the Jewish leaders received the news of the man's healing. This is John 5:15 through 18. "The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who made him well. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, 'My Father has been working until now, and I have been working.' Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God." The remainder of Jesus' response to the leaders is crucial to understanding the importance of the sign. So let's go ahead and read John 5:19 through 21 as well. It says, "Then Jesus answered and said to them, 'Most assuredly I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself but what he sees the Father do. For whatever he does, the Son also does in like manner. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he himself does, and he will show him greater works than these, that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will." The healing of the paralytic shows that Jesus gives life to anyone he wishes, regardless of how debilitating the person's condition is. We looked at one more sign last week, and that's the fourth sign of the feeding of the 5,000. And John's account of this sign is in John 6:1-14. Remember that John 6:9 tells us the only food available was 5 loaves and 2 small fish, and we know from verse 10 that the crowd included about 5,000 men, so women and children made the crowd likely between 10,000 and 20,000 people. Then look at 6:11-14 to see what Jesus did next. It says, "And Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples, and the disciples to those sitting down, and likewise of the fish, as much as they wanted. So when they were filled, he said to his disciples, 'Gather up the fragments that remain, so that nothing is lost.' Therefore they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the 5 barley loaves which were left over by those who had eaten. Then those men, when they had seen the signs that Jesus did, said, "This is truly the prophet who has come into the world." So the area was desolate, and the time was Passover. And in that way, Jesus was like Moses with the people in the wilderness who needed a miraculous feeding. So this sign shows that Jesus fulfills symbolism related to the provision of manna in the wilderness. And the sign also shows Jesus' power to create. So now we're ready to move on to new material and look at the fifth sign. And that fifth sign is Jesus walking on water. So that's what goes into your first blank there. We see Jesus walking on water. And that sign comes immediately after the verses we just read. So to set the stage, here are John 6, 15 through 17. "Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed again to the mountain by himself alone. Now when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and went over the sea toward Capernaum. And it was already dark, and Jesus had not come to them." We can get a little bit more detail by looking at Mark 6:45, because Mark's account of the gospel tells us why the disciples got into the boat. So listen to Mark 6:45. "Immediately he, Jesus, made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, when he sent the multitude away." So notice it says there that Jesus made his disciples get into the boat. Did Jesus know what was going to happen next after they got into the boat? So because he knew what was likely going to happen, and he did know it was going to happen, he obviously put the disciples in a position to learn a lesson. So let's go back to the Gospel of John and read verses 18 through 21 of chapter 6. John 6:18 starts like this. It says, "Then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat, and they were afraid. But he said to them, 'It is I, do not be afraid.' Then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going." Several unusual things happened in these verses. First, in verse 19, we see Jesus walking on the water. And walking on the sea is not something that Jesus did simply to amaze his disciples. It's a powerful and visible demonstration of Jesus' sovereignty over the world that he created. And look again at Jesus' quote in verse 20. The New King James translates the quote as, "It is I, do not be afraid." The clause, "It is I," is literally, "I am." We know those words are words that God used to describe himself to Moses. And in this verse, Jesus may or may not have used the phrase just to merely identify himself, but whether or not Jesus really intended to use the "I am" here to identify himself as God, other elements of the episode certainly do that. Look at verse 21. It says, "Then they willingly received him in the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going." So do you see another unusual event there that shows Jesus' control over nature?
Travel.
Can you imagine what the disciples must have felt like? They've been rowing all night and hadn't made progress, and then Jesus puts one foot in the boat, and immediately they're right where they're supposed to be. So the wording, "immediately the boat was at the land," indicates that another miracle occurred besides walking on the water, because the boat miraculously and instantly arrived at its precise destination just as soon as Jesus stepped on the boat. So this sign, of course, points to Jesus' deity, because only God could walk on the water, calm the sea, and then supernaturally transport the disciples to their destination. The sign also points to Jesus' deity in more than just these verses alone, because in the Old Testament, God alone rules over the seas. So just listen to how Psalm 107:28-30 parallel what we just read. Psalm 107:28-30 say this. It says, "Then they cry out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brings them out of their distresses. He calms the storm so that its waves are still. Then they are glad because they are quiet, so he guides them to their desired haven." So if God alone controls the sea in the Old Testament, what's the significance of Jesus controlling the sea in the New Testament?
It wasn't a power shift. It still resides in the same place. It's God.
Exactly. That shows that Jesus definitely is God. So the fifth sign then was a private affair for the disciples alone. But what happened on the troubled Sea of Galilee revealed Jesus as master of the elements. In the episode itself, notice that John makes no comment on the incident, but its impact on the disciples is evident in Peter's words later on in the chapter. Just scan down a few verses till you get to John 6, verse 69. Peter is speaking here, and he says, "Also, we have come to believe and know that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God." So remember that these signs are written so that people may believe, and obviously Peter is believing from this quote. The sixth major sign in the Gospel of John comes in chapter 9. So flip over to chapter 9, where we'll see the healing of the man born blind. So healing the man born blind completes that section of your handout. John gives us considerable detail about the man and the aftermath of his healing. So from his story, we're going to see more than just a sign. We'll see how several different groups of people react to Jesus. So we'll spend quite a bit of time looking at this sign. We're going to take the verses in sections, starting with verses 1 and 2 of chapter 9. They say, "Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, saying, 'Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?'" The disciples' question there reflects the assumptions that were customary in ancient Judaism, and that's that suffering could always be traced to sin. Their underlying concern was well-intentioned because they wanted to avoid charging God with doing anything wrong to innocent people, but it was very misguided to think that all suffering comes from sin. Let's see how Jesus answers that question by looking at verses 3 through 5. Jesus answered, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." So while sin may be a cause of suffering sometimes, as clearly indicated in Scripture, it's not always the case. And in this instance, Jesus made it clear that personal sin wasn't the reason for the man's blindness. What did Jesus give as the reason for the man's blindness? God allowed the man to be born blind so that Jesus could heal him and thus reveal the works of God and his healing power. So think of all the years that the man carried the burden of blindness until the time it could be used for God's glory. So if you want to reflect on that a little bit more, all of his life the man and probably nearly all of those around him had assumed that he was being punished by God. In reality, he was one of the people God had chosen to demonstrate a messianic sign that was written about all the way back by Isaiah. So let's go ahead and look at a couple of verses in Isaiah and read just one of the places where Isaiah prophesied how the Messiah would cure blindness. In 29:18 and 19 of Isaiah, the verses are speaking of when the Messiah would come. In 29:18 and 19 say this, they say, "In that day the deaf shall hear the words of the book, and the eyes of the blind shall see out of obscurity and out of darkness. The humble also shall increase their joy in the Lord, and the poor among men shall rejoice in the Holy One of Israel." That's not the only place in Isaiah where Isaiah said that the Messiah would heal the blind. Other places are Isaiah 35:5 and Isaiah 42:6-8. So while you're turning back to John 9 and thinking about that again, consider how the blind man's situation also may teach us something beyond the fact that Jesus is the Messiah. Think about this. Could God be using our suffering when it occurs to demonstrate his glory? So one more time, could God be using our suffering when it occurs as a way to demonstrate his glory? Let's pick up the narrative of the blind man again and read John 9, 6 through 12 to see what Jesus does next. Starting in 9, 6, it says, "When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva. And he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and he said to him, 'Go, wash in the pool of Siloam,' which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Therefore the neighbors and those who had previously had seen that he was blind said, 'Is not this he who sat and begged?' Some said, 'This is he.' Others said, 'He is like him.' He said, 'I am he.' Therefore they said to him, 'How were your eyes opened?' He answered and said, 'A man called Jesus made clay and anointed my eyes and said to me, "Go to the pool of Siloam and wash." So I went and washed, and I received sight." Then they said to him, "Where is he?" And he said, "I do not know." So in ancient times, severe physical deformities like congenital blindness actually sentenced a person to begging as the only means of support. The drastic change in the healed man really caused many to faithlessly believe that he must have been somebody else other than the person that was actually born blind. Then the largest section of chapter 9 shows us how most of the Pharisees resisted the truth. Let's go ahead and look at verses 13 through 17. Those say, "They brought him who formerly was blind to the Pharisees. Now it was a Sabbath when Jesus made the clay and opened his eyes. Then the Pharisees also asked him again how he had received his sight. He said to them, 'He put clay on my eyes, I washed and I see.' Therefore some of the Pharisees said, 'This man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath.' Others said, 'How can a man who is a sinner do such things?' And there was a division among them. They said to the blind man again, 'What do you say about him because he opened your eyes?' He said, 'He is a prophet.'" The Pharisees condemned Jesus based upon how they had added to the Sabbath requirements, because Jesus had kneaded clay with his saliva to make mud, and kneading dough was one of the other prohibitions that the Pharisees added to things that couldn't be done on the Sabbath. Of course, there was nothing wrong with kneading dough on the Sabbath as far as God's real law goes, but the Pharisees had added so many requirements that they ruled that Jesus had broken the Sabbath by breaking this requirement. Does that sound familiar with the other sign we looked at last week when they accused Jesus of breaking the Sabbath when he healed the lame man?
Mm-hmm. You thought Jesus would have been smarter than to do that on Sabbath.
You think it might be just on purpose that Jesus keeps doing these things on the Sabbath? So the blind man clearly saw that Jesus was more than a mere man, but the sighted and obstinate Pharisees were the spiritually blind ones to that truth. We know that blindness in the Bible can also be a metaphor for spiritual darkness and inability to discern God and his truth, and the Pharisees actually show us that very well. As we read on, we're going to see just how blind the Pharisees really were. Look at verses 18 through 23. 18 starts out, "But the Jews did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who had received his sight. And they asked them, saying, 'Is this your son who you say was born blind? How then does he now see?' The parents answered them and said, 'We know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but by what means he now sees we do not know, or who opened his eyes we do not know. He is of age, ask him, he will speak for himself.' His parents said those things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone confessed that he was Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore his parents said, 'He is of age, ask him.'" So when the parents refused to state an opinion, the Pharisees decided to put pressure on the healed man again. Look at verses 24 and 25. They say, "So they again called the man who was blind and said to him, 'Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner.' He answered and said, 'Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see.'" So after that, the Pharisees again put more pressure on the blind man, and they ask him to explain one more time what happened. And look at verse 27 for the blind man's answer, and then verses 28 and 29 for the Pharisees' response. This is one of my favorite responses in the Bible, actually, because verse 27 says, "He answered them, 'I told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciples?'" Says, "Then they reviled him and said, 'You are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from.'" To forcefully emphasize their hypocrisy, then, the healed man resorted to biting but true sarcasm when he suggested that they desired to be Jesus' disciples themselves. The healed man's wit really had exposed the bias of his inquisitors, because if the healed man defended Jesus, then such a defense could only mean that he was Jesus' disciple. And the formerly blind man continues his answer then in verses 30 through 33. It says, "The man answered and said to them, 'Why, this is a marvelous thing, that you do not know where he is from, and yet he has opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing.'" So the sixth sign featured in John's gospel then reveals Jesus as light of the world, like what Jesus said in the verses we read earlier. So again, Jesus is revealed here as the light of the world. And he's also unique because none of the prophets had cured blindness. This was actually the first time that somebody had cured the blindness. And for the seventh major sign in John, we need to move over to John chapter 11. And we'll start in verse 1. Because in John 11, we'll see Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. So your seventh sign is raising Lazarus from the dead. Then we'll read verses 1 through 4 of chapter 11. Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sister sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. When Jesus heard that, he said, This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it. So does verse 4 remind you of Jesus' words just before he healed the blind man? Do you see a theme starting to develop with all of these signs here? Let's read on and start reading verse 5, and we'll go through verse 7. It says, Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus, so when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, Let us go to Judea again. Most likely, by the time the messenger arrived to inform Jesus, Lazarus was already dead. The delay was because he loved the family, and that love would be clear to them, so when he greatly strengthened their faith, they would know just how much more he loved them. The delay also ensured that Lazarus had been dead long enough so that nobody could misinterpret the sign as some sort of fraud. It actually had to be a true miracle. So let's skip several verses and pick up the story when Jesus arrives at his destination. Look at verses 21 through 27 of chapter 11. We see the conversation here between Jesus and Martha. It says, Now Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, Your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world. And then a little bit later on in the chapter, Mary arrives, and she starts a similar conversation with Jesus. Look at verse 32. Then when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down at his feet, saying, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And then skipping down to verses 38 through 44, we'll see the Savior's power. So again, starting with 38, it says, Then Jesus, groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, Take away the stone. Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, Lord, by this time there is a stench, for he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God? Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me, but because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me. Now when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he who had died came out bound, hand and foot, with grave clothes, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, Loose him and let him go. Let's think about Jesus' prayer for a second here. Because his prayer was not really a petition to God, but thanksgiving to God. The reason for the miracle was to authenticate Jesus' claims to be the Messiah and the Son of God. So raising Lazarus from the dead is the seventh sign of Jesus' messiahship, and that of course shows the greatest miracle of all, giving life back to the dead. John documents opposite reactions to this sign in verses 45 through 48 of chapter 11. So let's look at those reactions as we read the verses. Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him, but some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." So now we're starting to see the real concern that the Pharisees had. They weren't trying to protect God as they tried to make it look like they were. They were concerned about losing their place and having somebody take away their nation. In verses 49 through 52, though, we see God's providence shine through even more, because God causes the unbelieving high priest to summarize the theological truth. John 11:49 says, "And one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, 'You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish.' Now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad." So even though the high priest was an unbeliever, God still spoke to him to summarize what Jesus' death and resurrection would do for all believers. So let's pause here for a second. Notice that says that Jesus will accomplish what he does not just for the nation, but for the children who are scattered abroad. Who are the children scattered abroad? Yep, they're Gentiles, and that, of course, includes all of us here today. We are part of those children scattered abroad. So Caiaphas didn't realize the implications of what he spoke. Because he uttered blasphemy against Christ, God actually parodied his statement, though, into truth. The responsibility for the wicked words of Caiaphas belonged to Caiaphas, but God's providence then directed the words to express the heart of God's glorious plan of salvation. So when you think of that, that's pretty significant in itself, because what Caiaphas intended really as blasphemy against God, God turned to use and summarize for his plan of salvation. So all the rejection and hatred couldn't dim Jesus' glory that was displayed through the resurrection of Lazarus. And that miracle really evidenced his glory in three ways. One, it pointed to his deity. We've seen that in the other signs so far as well. Two, it strengthened the faith of the disciples. And then three, it led directly to the cross. So we know that the Jewish leaders successfully carried out the plot to have Jesus crucified. But rather than end Jesus' influence, the crucifixion set up the greatest sign in John, and that's the eighth sign that comes in, and that, of course, is Jesus rising from the dead. So turn to John 20, and we'll read about Jesus rising from the dead. We'll start with John 20, verses 1 and 2. "Now on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. Then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, 'They have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him.'" So what does Mary's statement at the end of verse 2 tell us about whether Jesus' followers were expecting a resurrection?
She said that they weren't, because they didn't know where they had laid him, so she didn't think he'd risen.
Exactly. If they were really expecting a resurrection, what do you think she would have said?
"He's risen."
Yeah. "He's risen, let me go find out where he is so I can see him." Instead, she says they've taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they've laid him. We know that Jesus had predicted his resurrection numerous times, but really it was more than Mary could believe at this point. It would take him showing himself alive to his followers by many infallible proofs, as Acts 1:3 says, for them to actually believe. Let's go ahead and read on now, starting in verse 3 of chapter 20. "Peter therefore went out, and the other disciple, and were going to the tomb. So they both ran together, and the other disciple outran Peter, and came to the tomb first. And when he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen cloth lying there, yet he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came following him, and went into the tomb. And he saw the linen cloth lying there, and the handkerchief that had been around his head, not lying with the linen cloth, but folded together in a place by itself." The linen cloth lying there are clear evidence that Jesus' body had not been taken by grave robbers or his disciples attempting to steal the body, or even by his enemies, because none of those groups would have taken time to remove the cloth. It would have been much easier to transport a dead body if you left it wrapped, and it'd be a lot cleaner as well. Let's read on through verse 10 now. It says, "Then the other disciple who came to the tomb first went in also, and he saw and believed, for as yet they did not know the scripture that he must rise again from the dead. Then the disciples went away again to their own homes." So check out the difference between verses 6 and 8. Verse 6 simply said that Peter saw. What does verse 8 say about John, who's the other disciple there?
He
says he saw and believed. So, of course, we see a progression going on in these verses. And these verses also show how God covered all the details to prove the resurrection. To be recognized by the Jewish legal system, at least two men had to witness an event. So now you have two men witnessing that. So far, nobody actually had seen the risen Jesus yet, though, and that's about to change. Listen to John 20, 11 through 18. "But Mary stood outside by the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the feet, where the body of Jesus had lain. Then they said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping?' She said to them, 'Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him.' Now when she had said this, she turned and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?' She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, 'Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away.' Jesus said to her, 'Mary.' She turned and said to him, 'Rabboni,' which is to say, 'Teacher.' Jesus said to her, 'Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God.' Mary Magdalene came and told the disciples that she had seen the Lord, and that he had spoken these things to her." And this is just the first of several appearances that John records in chapter 20. So over the last two lessons, we've done a quick overview of the eight major signs in John. And by doing an overview like this, doing justice to any single one of the signs is impossible. My hope is that by putting the summaries of the signs together, though, in rapid fashion, we'll get a feel for just how much evidence John presented to show that Jesus is God and that Jesus is the Messiah. In the signs, we've seen Jesus demonstrate power over time. We've seen him demonstrate power over space. We've seen Jesus demonstrate how he fulfills Old Testament symbolism. We've seen Jesus demonstrate his creative power. We've seen Jesus demonstrate that he can heal and save whomever he wishes. We've seen him demonstrate his power over nature. And we've seen Jesus demonstrate his power over death in more ways than one. Over the years, many people have tried to disprove the resurrection, and Dr. Simon Greenleaf was a distinguished law professor at Harvard during the 1800s. He set out to prove the resurrection was a hoax, and after thoroughly examining the evidence, he came to a much different conclusion. This quote is from page 29 of his book, and I put it in your handout as well. He said, "It was impossible that the apostles could have persisted in affirming the truth they had narrated had not Jesus Christ actually risen from the dead." So God, through this evidence, converted Dr. Greenleaf, and the disbelieving professor had become a defender of the faith. So John said it best in verses 30 and 31 of chapter 20, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name."